Welcome to American Indian Living, a program developed by the Native Education and Health Initiative to improve and enhance the health of people throughout the Native communities. American Indian Living is hosted by Dr. David DeRose, a board-certified specialist in both internal medicine and preventive medicine. Dr. DeRose has a wide range of experience with Native health issues, and he's ready today to help you learn more about your health. Here's Dr. DeRose.
Welcome to American Indian Living. I'm Dr. David DeRose. In the studios with me today, Dr. Brian Schwartz. Dr. Schwartz is a cardiologist, a heart specialist based in Ohio, and he's here really to help us understand more about the heart, what we can do about it, and how we can really extend a long and useful life. Dr. Schwartz, it's great to have you in the studio with me.
Well, thank you, David. It's good to be here.
We've had the privilege of connecting over the years, Dr. Schwartz, and it's good, just to see you, but I know you have a wealth of information about the heart and blood vessel diseases, and I think as we speak about heart issues, nobody tuning in today throughout Indian country, even if they have no Native American backgrounds, everybody says, you know what, the heart, I mean, that's important stuff. We might talk about other things as physicians, and people might say, well, why is that important? But nobody argues when it comes to the heart. Talk with us about your work as a cardiologist. What are the kind of diseases, the kind of conditions that you see to kind of set the tone for today's program?
Okay, certainly. I absolutely agree with you that the heart's very important. Probably the only organ more important than that is the brain. And even then, the heart's important because it pumps the blood to the brain and as well as all the other organs of the body. So when we talk about heart disease, I think in terms of diseases of the heart, but also the vascular system. So we call it coronary artery disease and cardiovascular disease, which includes the whole vascular system, which is the system that pumps the blood to our organs. And so heart disease in particular refers to the buildup of plaque in the coronary arteries that supply the blood back to the heart so that that muscle can continue to do the work. And that's very, very prevalent in America and is really rising around the world.
Now, that term plaque, it's kind of a funny term. And I guess I say it's kind of a funny term because I've been to the dentist's office, and the dentist has told me things about plaque on my teeth, and then we hear about plaque in the arteries. What is this plaque that you're talking about in the arteries?
Well, that's a really good question. It is different, but possibly related to the plaque that you get on your teeth. So in the arteries, a normal artery is made up of three layers, what we call the adventitia, the media, and the intima. And those should be very smooth, just like the skin on the surface of your body. Mm-hmm. Your body is really lined with a skin called the endothelium that lines all the arteries and makes it very smooth and protects the arteries from disease. Plaque occurs when there's inflammation or an injury to that lining, that skin-like lining on the inside of the arteries. And inflammation can include infections that are even similar to what builds up on the teeth. It can include a lot of the things that we expose ourselves to, the foods we eat, particularly foods that are high in cholesterol and highly processed foods that are high in simple sugars, constantly bombard the lining of the artery. And gradually, plaque builds up as a result of that inflammation through cholesterol deposits and fat deposits on the inside of the artery that cause the artery to narrow. And as it narrows, it restricts the blood flow. And that's a result of plaque buildup.
Make this real plain for us. You've mentioned cholesterol-containing foods and highly refined foods. What do these look like? I mean, what are examples that some of our listeners might relate to that wouldn't be good for their heart arteries?
Yeah, I think the best diet is really food in its natural sources.
Okay.
So plants in particular, fruits, grains, and vegetables, especially in the Western world, in America, we have processed those foods. We've taken the natural sugar, like in beets or sugar cane, but we've concentrated it. Mm-hmm. We've take the fat found in milk or in eggs, and we concentrate it into ice cream. So foods that are particularly bad for us are the ones that are super concentrated. Rich foods like red meats, processed foods, things that you would normally get at a fast food restaurant, and the sugary foods like soda pop.
Okay, so basically what I hear you saying, Dr. Schwartz, is really a message that I've heard many times from other experts who've been on the show. They're saying, just go back to more of the traditional Native American choices, the beans, the squash, the wild rice, these plant foods that were eaten in abundance throughout Indian country before Europeans came to this continent.
Yeah, it seems like everybody in the world has wanted to eat like an American, and now Americans are starting to find out that that brings a lot of diseases with it. It actually reminds me of a Bible text back in Exodus 15, where God is leading the children of Israel to the Promised Land, and he promises them that if they follow his ways, his statutes, his laws, it says, I will put none of the diseases upon thee which I have put upon the Egyptians, for I am Jehovah that healeth thee. And what God did was took them out of Egypt, where they were used to the really rich foods. I think the Egyptians really had a diet that's very much like Americans. They didn't get a lot of exercise because they had the Hebrew slaves to do the work for them, just like we just use a remote control. I don't know that they had fast foods or fast food restaurants, but they had rich foods. They were a wealthy nation, and so they were eating the delicacies, a lot of meats and probably dairy products and things that just built up to cause plaque. I don't know, but perhaps did other things with alcohol or tobacco or things that just rich, affluent societies can do that could harm their bodies. And so God took the children of Israel out into the wilderness and taught them a very simple diet. And as a result, he promised them that they wouldn't have those same kind of diseases.
I mean, it's a fascinating analogy. I appreciate what you're sharing. I've actually studied some about Egyptian culture because I have an interest, like you, Dr. Schwartz, in indigenous peoples throughout the world. And it is true. Some of the Egyptian inscriptions I've seen, not that I can read hieroglyphics, but I've seen translations, speak about a mother waiting at home for her child with bread and beer. So, you know, the alcoholic beverages were there. I haven't found anything about tobacco. I've thought of tobacco as more of a kind of North American, or at least, quote, New World substance. And of course, Native Americans used it ceremonially. But I mean, your point is well taken. There's many of these potentially addictive substances, as well as the rich foods, which clearly were in that culture. So whether someone says, you know what, I believe that Bible story as truth, as God speaking, or they say, I think it's an interesting historical note, I, like you, do see that there's internal credibility to it, because when God mentioned this particular lifestyle, you know, this way of obedience, he was giving them a program that I find interesting from a Native American perspective is very much like the First Nation peoples in this continent followed. I mean, in the first chapter of the Bible, it's talking about a diet, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a big resurgence in America on trying to get back to food that's locally grown and back to its original natural state. And I believe that's how many indigenous people have lived for many, many years until we've developed a taste for this Western diet. And unfortunately, it's not the healthiest diet, particularly with heart disease.
Yeah, I appreciate the emphasis. And I know some of you tuning in today to American Indian Living, you're saying, you know, Dr. DeRosa, you've got a lot of interesting guests, and sometimes you get some people that start talking about some of these spiritual issues, and maybe they're coming from a Christian perspective or maybe from another perspective, and we're traditional Native Americans. We don't like the things that the so-called Christians did when they came to this continent. What's exciting to me, Dr. Schwartz, is the kind of things you're talking about help to level the playing field, because what they show me is whether someone comes at health from a holistic perspective that includes a Christian worldview, or whether it's someone in Indian country who says, look, I don't relate to that at all. If you really look at what you're sharing with us, the things, the simple teachings of the Bible, they're really very similar to what First Nation peoples appreciate from the beginning. And I have a friend who's Cherokee. He and I have done meetings together, and he often says, you know what, if you really just read the Bible, you don't listen to what some church is saying or some preacher. Says, you know, you look at what the Bible teaches and you look at how First Nation peoples lived on this continent, often they were better, quote, Christians than the people that came over from Europe and saying they were the Christians trying to help the native peoples.
I think you make a very good point. As I'm from European descent and grew up used to this way of thinking that all I could pretty much take over the land and use it for my own resources. But as Americans, we have developed this incredible greed. It takes incredible amounts of energy, cultivation of the soil, just to produce the meat that we're used to. And Americans eat four times more meat than the rest of the world, according to a Time magazine article in August of 2009. The amount of energy that goes in to produce that meat is incredible. It's not the way it used to be, where we might go out and hunt something that was on the free range and wasn't high in fat, but we want to develop that really super fatty meat. And so many of the turkeys and chickens and cows that we eat have never even tasted green grass or been out in the sunlight because they're manufactured in these huge factory-like farms that causes huge amount of contamination to the environment and uses up an incredible amount of resources. And so we can learn a lot from the cultures that are used to living off the land and in not living in such a greedy, all-consuming way without any consideration for what it does to other peoples and in the environment.
Well, let's bring this back to this whole subject of First Nation wisdom and how it relates to the heart. Because Native Americans, of course, traditionally, as you've pointed out, when they did include animal products, it was typically wild game that they were eating.
Mm-hmm.
And when I look at diet manuals, diet references, nutritional composition tables, I see that those wild game sources of nutrition were much, much lower in fat than the animal products that are typically being eaten today. As a cardiologist, this may not be a fair question because I don't know that this has actually been studied, but do you have a hunch? I mean, if someone were going to eat animal products, are they better off hunting their own buffalo or deer or catching their own fish than going to the store and buying these things?
Yeah, I don't know that there's been studies that absolutely prove that getting wild game is better than what you can buy in the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
But I do encourage my patients that if they do eat meat, that it should be occasional. It shouldn't be every single meal.
Mm-hmm.
I do encourage them to try to get grass-fed beef or meats that are not super high in fat. And that's really different than what you're going to get at the local fast food restaurant or even the supermarket unless you're buying organic free-range meats. So I do believe that the best diet is going to be more grain, fruits, vegetable-based.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not opposed to my patients adding occasional meat, but I encourage them to stick to the lean meats, fish or chicken that's been baked or broiled, never fried.
Do you see a difference when patients listen to that dietary advice compared to those who don't listen?
Oh, absolutely. Probably 90% of hearts, 90% of the patients with heart disease have brought that on themselves through the choices they make.
Wow.
Whether it be with smoking, with the diet they eat, the lack of exercise, it's very related. And I have, in my medical practice with 9 physicians, we have thousands of patients that have heart disease and have been treated for heart disease, but the ones that will really change their diet will try to get as close to a plant-based vegetarian diet as possible. The ones that give up smoking, give up consuming alcohol, and will incorporate exercise into their lifestyle, I almost never see them come back to the hospital with a heart attack.
Really? That's impressive. We're talking with Dr. Brian Schwartz. Dr. Brian Schwartz is a heart specialist based in Ohio. He's sharing with us his wisdom, how it relates to Native American wisdom when it comes to the heart. We've been speaking some about heart disease, blockage in the heart arteries. We call it coronary artery disease. He's got a lot more to come. You don't want to miss Dr. Schwartz, some great insights that will help you and your community. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Today's broadcast has been pre-recorded. However, if you have questions about today's show or would like further information, please call 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. We'll be right back after this.
Today's American Indian Living radio program is sponsored in part by Wimar Center of Health and Education. Located in the foothills of Northern California's Sierra Mountains, Wimar is home to the residential New Start Lifestyle Program that helps people of all races address diabetes, heart disease, obesity, and related conditions. To further assist Native Americans with their health, Wimar produces a wealth of free resources that can be accessed on their website at newstartclub.com. To learn more about how Wimar can change your life, you can call 1-800-525-9192. The number again is 1-800-525-9192. Or you can access them on the web at newstartclub.com. Again, that's newstartclub.com.
Some important social statements by United States citizens today on policy.
To be a good American, you've got to like people, share things, and not scream at people. And you should also help them, and then you can share at them.
A statement on historical tradition and our form of government.
I love America because it got government full of people and full of people. For the people.
A statement on down-to-earth American idealism.
I like living in America because it means freedom. It means that you can do most stuff you want as long as it doesn't, like, hurt anybody and you have to work hard to keep it.
America, a statement in summary.
I love America because everybody's equal. And when you play with other kids and they dunk you, you can dunk them back.
You're listening to Dr. David DeRose on American Indian Living. Your comments and questions are welcome. Call now at 1-800-775-HOPE. 1-800-775-4673. Here again is Dr. DeRose.
Welcome back to American Indian Living. I'm Dr. David DeRose. Today my guest is Dr. Brian Schwartz. Dr. Schwartz is a specialist in cardiology, and plain English, he is a heart specialist. He's walking us through some of the things that we can do to deal with heart disease. Dr. Schwartz, we've been speaking about the condition of coronary artery disease, contributor to heart attacks. And I think most people who are listening in, they say, well, I know about that. Either I've had a heart attack or I had angina, maybe had a procedure. What kind of options are there? Let's say someone comes to the hospital, you're called in as the cardiologist, and they're having a heart attack. Can you walk us through what the current treatment approach may look like?
Yeah, so the most devastating thing that can happen is to have a heart attack. And a heart attack means that the plaque that was there blocking that artery has probably ruptured, and now a blood clot, platelets are sticking to that rupture area and forming a blood clot that's completely blocking the flow to the artery. That causes intense, heavy sensation in the chest, what mm-hmm. we call chest pain, but it's really more of a pressure squeezing like an elephant sitting on the chest. It can cause you to feel nauseated or lightheaded or diaphoretic, and that's all signs that that muscle is starving for oxygen. It's not getting enough blood. And so it's really absolutely true that time is muscle. If we can get that artery opened up quickly and get the blood flow restored, we can save that muscle, but it needs to be done within just a few minutes to hours to be able to salvage that.
So as a cardiologist, if they call you down to the emergency room, they say, we just diagnosed this fellow's having a heart attack, maybe that's not the normal scenario. Maybe they've already started things in process, but at your center and in your practice, do you give medications by vein? Do you go in and do an immediate study with dye? What kind of things do you do?
Yeah, so if we can identify it very quickly, mm-hmm. in fact, ideally, even in the ambulance, we can get an EKG and identify a large heart attack.
Yeah, so you identify the large heart attack, and then what do you do from there?
Then as quickly as possible, we try to put into place a strategy to open that artery. Uh-huh. At some centers, that would include giving a clot-busting drug.
Okay, and they give that intravenously?
In the vein.
Uh-huh.
But that's fallen out of favor at most major medical centers because clot-busting drugs cause a lot of bleeding and actually potential for bleeding into the brain.
Uh-huh.
So a better therapy, but more expensive therapy, is to go directly to a cardiac catheterization lab. We call it the cath lab.
Uh-huh.
And we actually have a team of x-ray techs, nurses, and physicians always on call for any time of the day to take somebody directly to the cath lab. And our goal is to get them from the time they enter the hospital to have them upstairs and in the cath lab within 30 minutes and to try to get that artery opened.
So this is where when you take them into this cath lab, you're the one doing the procedure?
That's right. So I'm actually an interventional cardiologist, so I specialize in opening up blocked arteries. And in the middle of a heart attack with a blocked artery, everybody is rushing as quickly as possible. We need to get a catheter in one of the arteries. We can come through the artery in the wrist, the artery through the groin, mm-hmm. up the femoral artery, and we'll slide a little catheter and a little wire all the way up to the heart. We will direct that catheter down the three major arteries of the heart and inject a little bit of x-ray dye so that we can take an x-ray picture.
Mm-hmm.
That'll show us exactly where the blocked artery is.
Okay.
And if we can see exactly where that is, we'll slide a little wire and then a balloon, what's called angioplasty.
Mm-hmm.
We'll slide that balloon through that blocked area, blow up the balloon, which stretches that artery back open and breaks up the blood clot and restores the flow. At the same time, we're giving lots of medicines to treat all the inflammation and to treat the blood clot and to stop further blood clots from happening and trying to identify the underlying cause so that we can prevent this from happening again.
So you'll go in and presumably you'll see a complete blockage in one of these arteries?
If it's a true heart attack,
mm-hmm.
the artery will be completely blocked with no blood flow getting to that area of the muscle of the heart. If we don't get in within 6 hours and get that opened up, that's going to lead to scar tissue building up in the heart muscle. And with scar tissue, the heart's not going to be able to pump effectively, and so that would lead toward congestive heart failure or a very weak heart.
And so if you see this complete blockage, you're saying you can go in there with a wire and a balloon and open that complete blockage up?
So what's called angioplasty and often followed by a stent is to put a little wire right through that blocked area, to slip a little balloon catheter in there that breaks up or busts up that clot. And then we actually put a little wire mesh-like structure that expands over that balloon and keeps the artery propped open so that the blood flow can continue to go through there. There's also lots of clot-busting drugs and blood thinners that we use so that we don't get any more clotting at that site.
And so you're saying those drugs are going right into that artery that's blocked?
It's that's correct.
Going into the rest of the body?
Well, some of the medicines are given in the vein, and uh-huh. some of the medicines can be given right through the catheter.
Okay. So let's look at costs, because our society, whether we're talking about from a global perspective or whether you're saying a tribal health budget, this is not an inexpensive procedure. You're talking about a whole team and expensive drugs and surgeries. I mean, is there a typical price tag for these procedures? I know it's going to vary from region to region, I'm sure.
Yeah, I can't give you an exact cost, but this is incredibly expensive technology. In fact, as far as procedures done in America, we spend more money on cardiac angioplasty, heart bypass surgery, which we haven't talked yet about, but it's just another way to treat blocked arteries. Typical costs could be as low as $25,000 to $100,000 for patients that come in with a heart attack and have to be treated.
You said the lowest cost, $25,000 to $100,000?
Between $25,000 to $100,000 would be a usual cost.
And that's just for going in for a heart attack and having the blockage opened up and all?
That's right.
So that could, if you're a small tribe, that could break your budget pretty quick if you do a lot of those.
Yeah, the sad thing is that 90% of heart disease could be prevented. We'd much rather find out that someone has heart disease and treat the underlying causes early before it leads to a heart attack. But by the time we have to go in there, the therapies become very expensive and can be very devastating if there's if it's not recognized or not treated right away, leading to congestive heart failure and an incredible amount of cost that builds up as well.
So even if everything's done right, is there some risk of complication in just doing the procedure?
The biggest risk from having a heart attack is that you might not even make it to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So nearly 50% of patients will die from a heart attack because of sudden cardiac death.
50%?
As high as 50%.
Wow.
If you get to the hospital, then that risk is probably less than 3 to 5%.
Uh-huh.
So if we can get you to the hospital and recognize that you're having a heart attack, we can generally save your life. But a lot of people will die from their heart going into fibrillation, ventricular fibrillation, from that area of the muscle that's irritated becoming irritable, and then that just causes the heart to start beating erratically until it stops.
Uh-huh.
And that's called sudden death. If the paramedics don't come and shock your heart back into normal rhythm, using a defibrillator and get the medicine started, you could die before you get to the hospital.
Wow.
Once you're in the hospital, once we do this procedure, there is a risk from some of the blood thinners that they could cause bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
There can be some bleeding from where we put the catheter. There are some serious things that can happen, but fortunately, that's very, very rare.
Okay. So basically, I mean, one message is get to the hospital as soon as you start having symptoms. But the bigger message is try never to have the symptoms. Try never to have a heart attack.
Absolutely. So heart disease affects more than 60 million Americans.
Wow.
In fact, it's estimated that probably one out of every two adults over the age of 45 has some form of heart disease, whether it's mild plaque, high blood pressure, stroke, or congestive heart failure. But one out of every two Americans over the age of 45 is at risk for a heart attack because they have mild plaques in the arteries.
And so if someone either has this condition or is worried about developing the condition, we spent some time in the first segment where you shared with us from a nutritional standpoint that you're wanting these people to be eating as little in the way of animal products, as little milk and eggs and meat as possible. But what other things are on your list as far as avoiding to improving the likelihood of never having a heart attack?
Yeah, so it's very important to get a regular medical checkup, to see a primary care physician. And what's really important in that check is to review the risk factors that could actually be treated to prevent heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
So genetics does play a role. It's important to recognize that to see if someone's at risk. But you can't really do much to change that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's many other factors. So the big risk factors, we say there's five major risk factors. Probably number one on that list is smoking.
Okay.
Tobacco irritates the arteries continuously. It promotes the acceleration of plaque, makes you at much higher risk for having a heart attack. The good news is that if you quit smoking in the first year, your risk of a heart attack goes down by over 50% just in that very first year.
We want to talk a little bit more about this. We're speaking to folks throughout Indian country, and of course, tobacco is used ceremonially in many contexts. We do want to pick up on that train of thought and also talk about the other lifestyle things that can make a difference as far as your heart health. I'm talking with Dr. Brian Schwartz, a heart specialist. He's a cardiologist. He will be back with more you don't want to miss. Dr. Schwartz, stay tuned. We'll be right back.
American Indian Living will continue in a moment. If you have questions or comments about today's pre-recorded broadcast, please call 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673.
America's veterans have served our country in both war and peace.
It's because of people like you that we are free.
My class was learning about war and how hard it is.
I wanted to do something
to let them know how I feel.
Now there is a way to thank them for helping keep America free. Log on to thankyouveterans.org and type a personal message of thanks.
Dear Dad, I've recently come to understand how important your service to America was, and I just wanted to say thank you.
There are 26 million veterans living in America today, from World War II to Afghanistan and Iraq.
We carry our experiences inside. It's nice to have someone say thanks.
Let a veteran know you appreciate their service. Log on to thankyouveterans.org, a public service of Paralyzed Veterans of America.
You're listening to Dr. David DeRose on American Indian Living. Your comments and questions are welcome. Call now at 1-800-775-HOPE, 1-800-775-4673. Here again is Dr. DeRose.
We're back with American Indian Living, and we're back not only with Dr. David DeRose, that's me, but with my guest, Dr. Brian Schwartz. Dr. Schwartz, if you're just joining us, is a cardiologist. He's a heart specialist based in the state of Ohio. He's joining us today on American Indian Living. Someone that I especially value in the field of cardiology, because Dr. Schwartz does not just keep up to date on the current treatments, the drugs, the procedures, the surgeries, but he realizes the power of some of these approaches to health that have been valued by indigenous peoples throughout Indian country and throughout the world. And so Dr. Schwartz brings with him a wealth of information. We're speaking, Dr. Schwartz, of course, about coronary artery disease, about blockage in the heart arteries. And as we stepped away for the break, we were talking about tobacco. In Indian country, many people would say, okay, well, we can hear you. You're talking about someone who may be addicted to nicotine. But even if I am smoking a pack or two a day, I'm still going to smoke tobacco at the ceremonies. Is that something, is that a different issue for someone who's had an addictive relationship with tobacco, who's been, you know, smoking a lot, than someone who's never smoked addictively, if you will? Do you have a different level of concern as a cardiologist?
Yeah, I think absolutely the risk factor is somebody that's like a chain smoker. If you're smoking a pack per day of cigarettes every day, we know that that dramatically increases your risk for a heart attack. I don't know that there's a significant risk for occasionally smoking a cigar or a pipe or in a ceremony. There may be a small risk, but it's not anywhere near in the category of everyday exposure to a pack or two packs of cigarettes. Mm-hmm. And that's where we'd really put the focus.
Okay. And I guess one of the concerns, we haven't really talked about it other than you're mentioning it in the connection with heart attack. You talked about these serious heart rhythm problems. I guess one of the concerns, though, if you are seeing someone who has rhythm problems and not having actual heart attacks, you may be concerned about the nicotine, even if someone is using it sporadically. Is that true?
Yeah, we could talk about rhythm problems such as atrial fibrillation and things that cause palpitations. And in that case, we'd look at things like nicotine or caffeine or lack of sleep or stress.
Okay.
But those might be a little different than the actual cardiovascular risk factors.
Okay. So let's come back to the things that actually cause blockage in the blood vessels. And we've talked about tobacco and diet some. You said there were five that you focus on?
Yep. The next big one would be diabetes. Mm. And diabetes is also closely associated with obesity. And both of those are independent risk factors for heart disease. Diabetes has become an epidemic in America. One out of five Americans now has diabetes, and it's on the rise all over the world. And probably related to our Western diet, the fact that not only is diabetes on the rise, but preceding that, obesity is on the rise. So we have an abundance of food. We eat more than we really need. We don't exercise like we used to. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, we're gaining weight. That has huge implications for health. It has implications for national defense. It has implications for just how well we enjoy our lives, because it's really hard to get around when you're excessively overweight.
So as a cardiologist, you have patients coming into your office day in and day out. You're in the emergency room. You're in the cath lab, as you told us. You see a patient. Maybe he or she has significant problems with their weight, with their diabetes. Have you found some things that work as far as motivating people, encouraging them? What can help? Because a lot of times doctors get frustrated. They say, oh, I told my patient to lose weight and they didn't lose weight. But it's a bigger picture than that, isn't it?
Yeah, I hear from physicians that it's incredibly frustrating to get people to change their lifestyle. And for that reason, it seems like most physicians have even given up on trying to bring it up. But we also know from patients that it's less than 1 out of 5 doctors actually bring up their lifestyle and talk about the fact that they're overweight, that they're consuming too many calories and what they can do. So I think it goes both ways. It's sometimes frustrating to change our lifestyle, but nevertheless, that's the most powerful tool that we have available. We talked about the incredible expense of doing balloon angioplasty or open heart surgery. And what's really amazing is that lifestyle offers an opportunity for no expense to almost completely prevent that disease. And so making these lifestyle changes is actually powerful. So I believe that if we could get the message out and convince people that, number one, there is a problem. Back in the 1980s, less than 5% of the population was obese, which is defined as more than 20% over your ideal weight.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's more than 20%. So just in the last 20, 30 years, we've seen that quadruple as far as the incidence of obesity.
Wait, give me those figures again. What's the percentage
change? So, yeah, 1985, if you looked at states that had more than 20% of their population in the obese range, which is more than 20% over your ideal body weight, there were no states.
Oh, okay.
And by 2000, almost two-thirds of the states of the United States had more than 20% of their population obese.
Huh.
It's become a huge public health epidemic. And I do have patients that come into the office that say, you know, I don't know why I'm overweight. I really don't eat that much. And if you saw what I eat, I don't eat very much. Well, the sad fact is that if you're gaining weight, there's no other way to gain weight than that you're eating too many calories or you're not burning enough calories. And so as Americans, we've become very sedentary. We drive everywhere we go. We don't walk anymore. Very few people exercise. We use the remote control. The only place we walk seems to be to the refrigerator.
Okay.
And that's to get another quick snack food. And these snack foods are just powerfully loaded with extra, what we call empty carbs. And it's those excess sugars, excess carbs that are really adding to the obesity epidemic, and that's what's fueling the epidemic of diabetes.
Dr. Schwartz, there are many people listening today that have heart disease. Many of them have the very risk factors you've been talking about, and it's not just because they're Native Americans. This is a problem that affects people across racial lines. What have you seen work as far as connecting with someone? They're hearing the message, I should lose weight. They're hearing the message, I need to be concerned about controlling my diabetes better. But when you have a success story in your practice, do the patients ever say, well, this is what I did, or this is what you told me that really resonated with me?
Yeah, I think probably behind what's driving this obesity epidemic isn't just the fact that we have lots of food easily available, but we live in a very high-stressed environment. Mm. Everybody's on the go all the time. There's not enough time in the day. Families are breaking down. We don't see people getting together for family meals anymore, so you just grab a quick snack. If we're not looking at the root cause, Americans really are feeding their loneliness, feeding their stress by just grabbing a snack and grabbing something on the run, just stopping off at a fast food restaurant as they're heading to work, or just getting coffee and a donut as their breakfast. It's not grain-based cereals anymore. It's certainly not oatmeal or things like that we actually know can lower cholesterol. It's these incredibly calorically rich foods. So if we can get them to, the things that work are to get them into a support group. Just like we know Alcoholics Anonymous works for alcoholics, getting into something like Weight Watchers or getting into a program where there's other people fighting the same disease is very helpful. Having them keep a log of what they're actually eating so they can see, well, maybe I am eating more than I thought I was.
Okay.
And it's probably, they're not eating that much for meals, but what they don't realize is they are getting it in the snacks that they eat all day long.
Mm-hmm.
So if they could just cut out the snacks, maybe they could cut out one meal a day and just focus on breakfast and lunch and a very, very light supper, or just some way that they could cut back. If they could cut back just a third of their calories every day, they would see an improvement. And then, of course, we emphasize trying to become more active, more physically fit, start adding exercise to their program.
Well, there's a lot of interesting aspects to a number of the things you've mentioned, but I was especially interested when you talked about cutting back on calories and maybe skipping a meal. I think the average person, if you told them to skip a meal, they'd say, well, it's easy, I can skip breakfast. But you didn't mention skipping breakfast, I noticed.
Yeah, I think that probably the most important meal of the day is breakfast. After we've slept all night, we need to recharge our bodies and get ready for all the activities of the day. And if we're going to eat a large supper and then quickly go to bed, there's no time to burn that off. So the supper meal is going to be more likely converted to fat.
Okay.
The breakfast meal is going to be more likely be the energy that drives you through the day and actually keeps your mind sharp, gives you the energy to be active, to be more physically fit, and to do a better job, providing it's not a super high sugary, super fat-loaded meal. So contrary to what's typically seen, it would make sense to actually eat your largest meal for breakfast, probably a smaller meal for lunch and a very small meal for supper, or try to go down to two meals a day if you really have a big problem and you need to get your weight down.
Now, one of the things I think is fascinating from the standpoint of Indian country, Native Americans, of course, have always had a strong emphasis on community.
Mm-hmm.
And although the pressures, like you've mentioned, of the dominant culture have been forced on Native Americans, and many of them can feel very time pressured as well, I find it interesting because one of the things you're talking about is the need for social support and social connectedness. And I know when I've been on reservations or in other tribal settings, I can think, very recently doing some lectures and presentations at a tribal health center, a number of the people there, people from those tribal communities in that region were coming together, they were supporting one another. And then they actually fed them a heart-healthy, diabetes-friendly meal. Some people would probably look at that in kind of with administrators' eyes and say, well, you don't need to be feeding these people. And I didn't say that was happening in that clinic. I'm just saying I know in some health systems, maybe not as much in Indian country, but what I hear you saying, Dr. Schwartz, is when we make an investment in teaching and support and getting people to eat healthy and coming together, this may be some of the most cost-effective investments we can make.
As our whole country has been looking at the rising cost of healthcare and recognizing mm-hmm. that it's becoming almost unsustainable to keep doing what we're doing, the only thing that really makes sense is to try to educate all groups of people in our country to how they can eat better, how mm-hmm. they can have healthier lifestyles, especially since we're beginning to recognize that most of these diseases can be prevented through those simple means.
The powerful message. Have we talked about all the main lifestyle things that you like to cover?
No, there's two more things that we need to be aware of. One of them is hypertension, so it's important to get your blood pressure checked at a doctor's office or screening program, the pharmacy, at least once a year. And more often if it's high.
Okay.
We used to say that ideal blood pressure was less than 150 over 90, but recently the guidelines have been lowered to actually less than 135 over 85. So we want to keep that number down as low as we can get it.
Well, we've got more on cardiology, heart health with Dr. Brian Schwartz, a cardiology specialist. We've only got one more segment in today's show, but it's going to be information-packed. You want to stay tuned with us. Dr. Schwartz is with me for the duration today. More about your heart, things you can do that can make a difference for you and your loved ones. Stay tuned for more. We'll be right back.
Today's broadcast has been pre-recorded. However, if you have questions about today's show or would like further information, please call 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. We'll be right back after this.
Today's American Indian Living Radio program is sponsored in part by Weimar Center of Health and Education. Located in the foothills of Northern California's Sierra Mountains, Weimar is home to the residential New Start Lifestyle Program that helps people of all races address diabetes, heart disease, obesity, and related conditions. To further assist Native Americans with their health, Weimar produces a wealth of free resources that can be accessed on their website at newstartclub.com. To learn more about how Weimar can change your life, you can call 1-800-525-9192. The number again is 1-800-525-9192. Or you can access them on the web at newstartclub.com. Again, that's newstartclub.com.
With nerves of steel, with incomparable courage, with fierce determination, with uncompromising resolve, the men and women of the United States Armed Forces go forth. And wherever and whenever they go, the USO will be there to touch their spirit, to comfort them, to remind them, to simply and heartfully thank them for the extraordinary gift they give us all. Until every brow is soothed and every hand is held, until every battle's won and every song is sung, until everyone comes home. Find out more about the USO and how you can help at USO.org.
You're listening to Dr. David DeRose on American Indian Living. Your comments and questions are welcome. Call now at 1-800-775-HOPE, 1-800-775-4673. Here again is Dr. DeRose.
Dr. David DeRose and Dr. Brian Schwartz in our final segment of today's edition of American Indian Living. Dr. Schwartz, a cardiologist, a heart specialist who's bringing some great information to Indian country and beyond, speaking about things that we can do to improve our heart health. Dr. Schwartz, you've been walking us through some of the things we can do to decrease our risk of a heart attack or heart procedure, everything from improving our diet to exercise, losing weight, controlling our diabetes. We're talking about blood pressure now. And like you said, a lot of people have gotten complacent, even in the medical community over the years, with higher blood pressures than optimal. Are there lifestyle things that can be done to help lower blood pressure, or is it just a matter of having to take more medications?
No, absolutely. Diet, again, is important. This is where we do emphasize the amount of salt someone consumes.
Uh-huh.
But hypertension is also related to plaque buildup in all the other arteries of the body, and as the plaque builds up, they become stiffer, they become less elastic, less able to relax and expand, and so the very same things that help prevent heart disease can help prevent hypertension. So preventing or lowering the saturated fat in our diets. Exercise is a very powerful tool for reducing the blood pressure. And something that might be even more common, actually, in Native Americans is meditation.
Meditation?
Things that people can do to relax and just try to get some time, a way to kind of contemplate and deal with the stress that is in their lives.
So, hypertension, I know a lot of people, they hear that word and they say, well, I'm not under stress at all, and yet we measure their blood pressure and it's high. From a medical standpoint, high blood pressure, hypertension, are we talking about the same thing or is that something different?
Yes, hypertension and high blood pressure, I would say, are the equivalent, talking about the very same disease.
Okay. So we've been walking through this list. Is there anything else that you want to tell people who are either afraid of having problems with their heart or have known heart disease that they should be considering?
Well, the other big risk factor that we've talked about in passing is cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very important to know your cholesterol. To get screened for cholesterol, even now it's recommended to get screened for cholesterol in the teenage years because we're recognizing that this is a very big, important problem. One out of two Americans over the age of 45 has high cholesterol. We now know that it's not just the overall cholesterol that's a problem, but that there is good cholesterol and bad cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
Good cholesterol is called HDL cholesterol. It's actually protective for the heart. The higher the level is, the better off someone is.
Okay.
But the bad cholesterol is LDL cholesterol. And as a general rule, sources of cholesterol that are rich in the HDL, the good cholesterol, include plants. Mm-hmm. Plant-based diet raises your good cholesterol, which can be protective of the heart. But the factors that raise the bad cholesterol, the LDL cholesterol, are more related to animal fats. So in general, an animal fat-based diet is going to raise your bad cholesterol. A plant-based diet is going to raise your good cholesterol. And so that's why we emphasize a diet that's high enrich and plant-based, and that is sparingly using animal products.
So let me see if we're getting this straight. You're actually suggesting, Dr. Schwartz, that we don't just check cholesterol in adults, but we actually get serious about checking cholesterol in younger people. And I know when I get cholesterol tests from the lab, What I tend to find is that the lab reports a normal cholesterol level as something under 200. Now, this is the total cholesterol. If you have a 12-year-old and you check their cholesterol level and it's 190, are you going to be happy with that?
The goal is to keep the total cholesterol less than 200,
mm-hmm.
but I would want to know what the ratio of the good and the bad cholesterol is.
Okay.
We would like to see a whole profile, not just the total cholesterol. And nowadays, when you get your cholesterol checked, it will usually include the good, the bad, as well as the triglycerides.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so basically, we're saying know your cholesterol number, and if that ratio, if that total cholesterol or that LDL bad cholesterol in particular is higher, the HDL is lower, you want to do something and try to improve those numbers. And one of the places you're saying we should start, Dr. Schwartz, is by making better dietary choices, which, again, brings us back to that topic at the beginning of the show, where we're really encouraging people to eat more of those foods that were valued throughout Indian country, those simple plant foods that were so common throughout most tribes before Europeans came here. One of the things is, I'm just going to be real honest with you. A lot of the stuff we've been talking about on the show is not new information to people. And a lot of times my patients probably tell me the same thing that they tell you. They say, oh, yes, I know this. I know I should be exercising more. I know I should lose weight. The question is, what can help people be successful? From your perspective as a cardiologist, have you found certain strategies, certain interventions, certain educational techniques that help people be more successful?
Yeah, so to put this whole package together, if someone has heart disease, I try to review all five of the big risk factors. There's other blood tests and things that we check, but we try to identify all the risks, and then we use that as a way to educate them about the changes that they can make.
Mm-hmm.
There
mm-hmm.
are powerful medicines that can bring down your cholesterol and can bring down your blood pressure, and they actually do help prevent future heart attacks.
Okay.
But the place that we start is with lifestyle changes. One of the things I've found in my practice is it's incredibly hard to motivate lifestyle changes. We're bombarded by advertisements on TV and in our social groups. It's everything revolves around food, and it's got to taste good. But if we can create a culture, an environment through church groups, through community groups, through various groups where it's a culture of health as opposed to a culture of just treating disease, that's going to help people motivate change. So that support group is really, really important. In my own practice, there's one other tool that I do use. I do believe that there is a power of prayer. And I will often ask my patients that if they'd appreciate it if I pray for them, then ask God to give them strength to make changes in their life. And just turning to a higher power and recognizing that they don't necessarily have the ability to make those changes that involve their willpower by themselves. But if they can look to a higher power, a source that can give them the strength to make that change, they're far more likely to be successful. And I've had numerous stories of patients that come in who have come in just less than a year later and have lost over 100 pounds. They've quit eating fast foods. They've given up smoking a pack per day. They've started exercising. When I ask these patients, wow, how did you make all these changes? Did you start going to the YMCA or did you start doing things differently? They'll say the one thing that gave them the power to change was the fact that I prayed for them. And when they knew that God would help them make that change, it was powerful to make a change in their life.
Well, I think a lot of people tuning in are thinking this is pretty remarkable. Here you are, a board-certified cardiologist. You're a highly trained medical professional. And in a lot of people's minds, well, medical things are in one compartment and then spiritual things are in another. And one of the things I appreciate about you, Dr. Schwartz, is I've known you for a number of years, and you have this more holistic perspective that people throughout Indian country relate to. You can't compartmentalize the spiritual, the mental, the emotional, the physical. And whether someone prays to the Creator, whether they pray to a great spirit, whether they pray to God, I mean, we could have a discussion as to whether we're all praying to the same individual. But here's the interesting thing that I hear you saying. It's not just enough to know. Most of us seem at some level to need a power outside of ourselves to make optimal changes. And you're just sharing with us as a clinician that this is what your patients tell you, that was so powerful, right?
That's right. It seems to be, when they look outside of themselves, having a social group is very important, but having a faith in a higher power seems to give them the power to make those changes and to recognize that they can get through it.
Wow. So basically, Dr. Brian Schwartz has been giving us some really great information in today's show, things that can make a difference. And Dr. Schwartz, as the clock is ticking away rapidly, do you have some summary statements for us? If someone has been listening, what would you like to encourage them to do with the information we've shared?
Well, we used to think that heart disease was unavoidable, but now we know that it's directly related to the way that we live. Mm-hmm. And also, if you have heart disease, we now know that it can actually be reversed. We didn't get a chance to talk about that, but through diet, exercise, lifestyle, you can reverse heart disease and never need to go through an angioplasty, a stent, or open heart surgery.
So the same things that can prevent heart disease can help reverse the blockages?
That's now being recognized in the medical community.
Powerful stuff. Dr. Brian Schwartz, heart specialist, cardiologist. Hopefully you've heard some things today that will motivate you to make some changes in your life and be an agent of change in your community. I'm Dr. DeRose.
This is Life Talk Radio.